That's good, man. That sums up this week.
It does.
You know, this has been a crazy week. Okay, we're here. We're all in a group. There's Fish and Frank here, Robert in a chair across from me, and up in the chromed and gold-gilted towers of control and power.
Don't forget to mention the sparklies.
The sparklies. I almost forgot. He bedazzled his tower. So, RJ in command and control. Just to let you all know, I've been talking about my dad, and he'd been in the hospital and that, and my father did pass away. And, you know, I don't know, but there's got to be more juniors out there. Now, RJ, I don't know. Are you a junior?
I'm like RJ Molloy the eighth.
The eighth. Okay.
The eighth. So my father was Robert John. My grandfather was Robert John. So on and so forth down the line to some ancestor that got hung for stealing goats or something like that. And so they used to call me Little Robert. And I said to myself when I got to puberty, this is going to screw up my sex life. So,
yeah.
So I insisted on RJ. And then to end the story, my sister married a Scottish guy.
Okay.
And of course, they named the first son Robert John, and they call him Wee Robbie.
Wee Robbie?
Wee Robbie. That kid's screwed.
Oh, man. But you know better than I do how difficult it is when your parents pass away. You know,
yes.
you have all these, you know, emotional feelings, and, you know, you're a little distraught and stuff, but I consider myself extremely lucky because I'm almost 62. I've known my dad a long time, and when he died, we were very good friends, so, you know, I could sit around and whine and cry because I didn't have more, but I would rather think, you know, I was pretty lucky. You know, I got to know him for a long time and become friends with him as an adult. And I don't think you can get much better than that.
No, you can't. You got to go fishing with him, too.
Oh, no.
A lot.
We went fishing, and, you know, I've done all kinds of crazy business ventures. I was contracting for the feds and the states and universities and all kinds of work on the water, different programs and studies and projects. And he worked with me on a lot of those. And but, you know, you're RJ. Well, I have a family nickname as well because whenever my parents were always in one business or another. So whenever someone would call Frank or Bud or whatever, they would, the wrong one would always show up. So one of the women asked me, what's your middle name? And I said, Warren. She says, well, from now on, you're BW. So it's the only name I had different than my father. Because like you, I hated, you know, Little Frank and Junior and all that.
Right, right.
Just, no, that's not going to happen. And, but my dad, we have an extra layer of unusual with this because he was Fish and Frank, you know, and he started the store.
He was the original Fish and Frank?
He was the original Fish and Frank.
Wow.
And so I had to write the obituary for my father. And not only is it tough to write an obituary for your father, I have to explain to people, I'm very sorry, but my father passed away, but I'm still alive. You know, the store's still there. You know, I make a living there. 16 other people make a living there. So it was, as always, my dad and I, I think anybody out there knows their father would say, your relationship can be challenging at some point.
Yes.
And right up till the end, he posed another challenge. How do I tell people, you know, I'm sorry my dad did pass away, but I'm still alive, store's okay, we're still here, everything's okay.
Well, that's a great bit of history. He was the original Fish and Frank.
Yeah, and I was 1992 when I bought them out. And everybody says, oh, you're so lucky your parents gave you the store. And I always think to myself, yeah, that sounds good, but how do you negotiate price with your mother?
Right.
This is what mom wants for it, take it or leave it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was a lot of money. So probably about twice what a normal store would go through. But over the years, we've had our challenges. and Dad was not passionate about churches. I would say that's a reasonable statement.
And I think he passed that on to his son.
And, you know, definitely no funeral home, so we decided we're having a memorial and we're going to do it at the store. It's the only place he hung out. It's where he liked to be. So even after he decided he was going to retire, didn't want all the stress and everything, and said, yes, you can have all that stress. So, but I've had a lot of fun there over, it's been 27 years now I've had the store. 28 years, 27 years, I don't know, something like that. But anyway, yeah, Dad was the original fishing Frank, got me started fishing up in the Northwoods of Wisconsin originally. I'm actually from Illinois, fished a lot of the creeks and stuff and catching frogs and minnows and stuff as a little kid, and then going up into the farm country of Wisconsin, and we had a river behind the house, and me and the golden retriever, Dad taught me about guns and how to hunt and how to fish. And I would go down to the river with the golden retriever, just the fishing pole, the shotgun, the golden retriever, and a jug of water. And I'd be down there for the weekend at 11 years old, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd catch bluegills to eat, put them on a stick in front of the fire, shoot some ducks in season, you know. Interesting life, you know. But again, that was years and worlds away. People nowadays think of an 11-year-old with a fishing pole, a shotgun, and a dog going down to spend the weekend on the river. And I think I took a blanket with me. That was about it, outside a jug of water.
Yeah, nowadays somebody would call DCF on you, you know.
Yeah, and to me it was the perfect way to grow. I would just walk through the cornfields. The other side of the cornfield, there was a little bit of grass area. Then the creek, the river was right there. Had a place all set up, so...
Well, it's different times, Frank. It's definitely different times. I'm sure there are pockets in the country that where that still goes on. But
I would hope so.
I would really like to hope so.
Yeah. I would like to hope that still goes on out there. But a lot of memories of my dad going on this last week, trying to make a lot of phone calls. I didn't post anything on my social media accounts. Other people are. But for some reason or another, I just don't think social media is for personal stuff. If it's that personal to you, I don't want my friends and family finding out that way. And so I've literally made 500 phone calls here, trying every day to make more and get everybody caught up. If I haven't gotten to you, there's two possibilities. You were either in my last phone or the phone before. Or, you know, but I've been a little scattered. But the store's going on. Everything's going well, you know, and I'm actually just feel I was pretty lucky about the whole thing. I mean, went out a winner. That's all you can hope for.
No, I think you went out a winner, and honestly, I know from several of his, because he's about as, I don't know, open, complimentary as some other people. But he...
What? Moi?
Yeah.
I'm like square fruit.
I know.
I fell out of the tree, landed right next to it, didn't roll 4 inches. Square fruit.
Didn't move a
square fruit,
inch.
I like that.
Yes.
But, no, he on several different occasions mentioned how impressed and proud he was with what you've done with the shop. Because when I started with you 21 years ago, I mean, what we've done since then, you have done with us is unbelievable. Yeah. And I know it has boggled him beyond belief.
Well, we started out
in an amazing way.
A $2,000 inventory in the store when I actually bought the store, and we have $500,000, $750,000 worth of inventory in there now.
Yeah.
And we've all put in a lot of work, everybody at the store. You know, I guide the ship, but there's somebody else rowing and somebody setting up sails. And there's it takes a lot of us, 17, as a matter of fact.
It does. But I think he was definitely impressed with what you've done in a lot of ways. Plus, you know, I got to fish with him a couple times, which was always kind of fun.
Definitely a unique experience.
Fishing with him?
Being around him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Exceedingly funny, but the perfect duality of man. Everybody always assume people are good or bad. And that's really the least true statement in the world. everybody I've ever met, and even when you hear about horrible people, oh, but they were so, they were so nice, and they did this, and they did charities, and in the meantime, they were murdering people.
Right.
And I literally think pretty much everybody on the planet has some good and some bad in them, and we all have our quirks.
Yes.
Yeah, so let's just say my dad was unique. He was a lot of fun, a little different. I'm going to miss him, and we'll do what he would do. We'll back on to the fishing.
Yeah.
Now, RJ, I handed you my favorite toy, my favorite display piece. I built the first one of those probably 20-some years ago. And what RJ is holding is a stick, and onto it we have two swivels. One's a barrel swivel, and the other's a ball bearing swivel. And then we have about 18 inches of 12-pound test monofilament with a 1-ounce sinker on the bottom. Now, what this is going to show you, now the one on the left, or the right-hand side, yeah, that, the other left, no, you were correct, that one. Now, that's a regular barrel swivel. And I wish we could come up with a better name for it, because swivels don't swivel, boys and girls. They just don't. You, without the added benefit of ball bearing, when you look at a barrel swivel, you're going to see there's two tabs bent out that fit in a steel drum, but it's metal on metal. And metal on metal doesn't turn. Just spin that weight on the bottom of it. Just give it a good flick like that. Spin it like real fast. The swivel isn't turning at all, is it?
No, not at all.
1 ounce of pressure locks that up. That's kind of amazing. You wouldn't think
so. It is. I thought it was going to spin, and it didn't. And I'm really giving this thing a twist to get it to go.
All right. Before we move on to the other one, people say, well, then why would you ever use a swivel that won't actually swivel? Well, there's two things about this. I'm going to have you at this point, RJ, spin that weight so it's just really twisted up, and then grab hold of it and hold it still. All right? Now, watch the swivel and lift your hand up a little bit. Look at that.
It spun, yeah.
It spins. So if you're bottom fishing and you have a swivel connecting your line to your leader, this is the best way to join your line and leader together. It's the most positive, strongest connection you can make, especially if you're using a very light line and a very heavy leader. It eliminates all that cut through. It's really a great thing. But now, when that hit the bottom, that would take all the twist out. It would spin. It would do its job because you released the pressure. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the other one is an AFW American Fishing Wire ball bearing swivel. Spin that one. Here we go. And the results are?
Spins like a helicopter, yeah?
Crazy, isn't it?
And the line didn't twist either.
So the truth of the matter is, if you're going to use a swivel for casting or trolling, where you're putting weight on it and continuously moving something through the water, trolling it behind a boat, casting it out and reeling it in, you want to have a ball-bearing swivel. A normal swivel is simply a line connector. The best way to join your line and leader together is a swivel. Ultimate line connectors. So, what do you think of the display?
It makes sense to me now. You know, as we've talked about this over time, I've always thought, well, why wouldn't you use anything but a ball-bearing swivel?
Well, they're a little more expensive. You know what I mean? And if you're just bottom fishing, especially with a lot of people on the boat, whether you're inshore or out in the Gulf, swivels can get to be a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're a couple of bucks for a big pack of American Fishing Wire, and that's an American Fishing Wire barrel swivel. It's one of the best made. So when you do that AFW swivel on there, you mistakenly think it will swivel. But what it does allow you to do, let's say you get 30-pound braid and you want to use 50 or 60-pound leader, that 30-pound braid will cut right through that 50 or 60-pound leader in just a heartbeat. It's like putting a knife edge on it.
Right.
And even if you double it up.
Yeah, with a lot of pressure on it, it'll, even with not a lot of pressure on it at times, it'll cut right through itself.
Yeah, and that was always a problem with the older spider wire, too. When you tied it to monofilament or even the braided line, it cut it. So, yeah, you had to use some kind of connector. That makes a lot of sense.
So normal barrel swivels, non-ball bearing, we call them line connectors. They're the best way in the world to join two of them together because you can tie a good knot on one side, a good knot on the other, and I use a uni knot or a doubled line uni to make it even stronger, and bada bing, we got a great connection. But now, swivel scarefish. Yeah, right. What kind of mental midget came up with that one? You got to go back in history. You can't just look at your last Facebook post and say, okay, the world's 97 degrees and it's been 97 degrees every day of the whole planet lived there. If you go back during a time when we had monofilament line and mono leader. Now, RJ, you know what I mean by leader spool? You know, it's that kind of thin ring with a big hole in the middle and you pull your leader out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That was invented by a guy named Grant. And he's a very good friend. He's a super nice guy. And people don't realize where that actually came from. Picture in your head this leader. You know, you get a spool of leader and it comes in this package. It's about an inch wide. And it's just a circle, like a very open donut, right? Mm-hmm. That is called a wrist spool, like the wrist between your arm and your hand. And where that actually came from and what it was invented for is people in New York, Boston, Chicago, D.C., big cities who had big department stores. These huge department stores, they do these window displays. And they found very early on that monofilament line could be run across, you could hang shirts off of it or backdrops, and it's almost invisible when you're looking at it rather than string, which would detract away from their displays. So they would have monofilament on those, and they would put their hand through the hole, and it would hang on their arm like a bracelet, and they could just run the line tight to one end, run it over to the other end, cut it, and it's actually for doing windows displays. So Grant saw this and saw, wow. What he did was take monofilament line and have some made that was a more abrasion resistant than regular monofilament line. So he came out with using monofilament for leader. A few people had been doing it, but believe it or not, before that was done, most people used a steel leader.
Right.
If you got into heavy fish or bigger fish, you just simply put a steel leader on. You didn't, you know, or ran your line all the way to end. If whatever line you had on your rod, if you weren't using a steel leader, you would just tie it to your hook or to your lure. But it got so heavy you couldn't throw it. So he made it convenient to have leader to carry with you. So if you've got clear monofilament line and clear monofilament or later fluorocarbon leader, so you've got the line and the leader and you tie it together, and then you tie your hook or your lure on, at that point, what would be the only thing out of place? The swivel. Everything else is clear plastic. Now you got a metal swivel there. So in order to reduce that last little bit of, oh, look at that thing, we tied line to line. Because the swivel was the last thing that could possibly spook the fish. Not that it was going to, because, I mean, a year before, we were using steel leaders. But it was the one last thing, the last piece of metal in this perfect line of clear plastic. And that went from, oh, you can't use a swivel because it will spook the fish, from, okay, we're going to get this last bit out of the way, and one thing less likely to spook a fish. And it's all about the number of hits you're getting. And braided line comes out. And people say, oh, you can't use a swivel to put between your braided line and your leader because that will spook the fish. But braided line has the invisibility qualities of steel leader. Literally the same as steel leader. So putting a swivel on the end is going to spook a fish? Give me a break. And the same idiots who tell you this will grab a split shot, throw it on the line, and a big chunk of lead won't spook a fish, but a little metal swivel will. So there goes your myth. There goes your legend.
Well, it's the same way with the colored lines. They believe like the dark green line is supposedly better to use because it's less visible to the fish, but it's still a solid object in the water. It's still a steel leader, essentially.
But that's still just what they believe.
Right.
I watched pink line outfish green for almost 2 years.
Right.
We caught 10 fish on pink for every one fish we caught on green.
Right.
And is it because pink was a better color? Not so much.
No, probably not.
No, but what it was nobody had pink line before that. So this pink braided line comes out, and not all women like the color pink. I mean, quite a few women do. Pink's a nice color. But not all women do. So some women had pink line on there, and none of the guys wanted pink line. The only people who were throwing pink was the guys who worked at Fish and Frank, a couple of tournament anglers, and a few women. So it was brand new. The fish had never seen it. So for the first 2 years, it outfished everything. It was the best color you could get. Guys, oh, I got to have green, that pink, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, you know, but in the meantime, we were whacking them with it. It was literally the best color we've ever for the first 2 years. Now, it's about the same as the pink or the yellow or the green or whatever. They're all kind of the same.
Right. No, and I can see that, you know, and it's like a lure on a specific body of water that gets used over and over again. You know, the fish do start to become acclimated to both the sight, the sound, and the vibration of that particular thing. So,
especially if you're doing catch and release.
Right.
You know, they become acclimated to not going after a particular thing because there's a problem when you go after that thing. There's a bunch of studies out, too, about fish vision, how fish see. And one of the things I'm thinking of is they talk about the focal length of a fish's eye, how far away it can see before everything blurs. And it's actually pretty close to their head that they can see things sharply. And so anything after that starts to blur more and more and more. So there's a good possibility that with a lot of lines and swivels and things like that, at a certain distance, they don't see it. It doesn't come across as a sharp object to them, you know, an in-focus object. It's not until the fish is going to strike whatever it's going to strike that focus vision comes in. Because fish irises and eyeballs don't get bigger and smaller like the iris do. So they're fixed focal length.
All right. Now, what I would say, though, is from the time they're a very tiny fry, people always think of redfish as this big.
Yes.
You know, they're 18 inches, and they just magically appear at 18 inches. It's like, we asked the question, how many people at the Luigi's meeting last night thought the state closure had made the fishing so good right now? Because the fishing's great right now. And how many people think that the state closing snook, redfish, trout have brought all these fish up for us to catch this year because the fishing is just so good? And probably half the room raised their hand. And I says, all right, now I think we're going to have to go back to sex ed here, boys and girls. In school, they used to teach sex education. Well, you actually have males and females have to get together and make the eggs and the sperm to get together, fertilize the eggs. Then the eggs, you know, are released as babies in fish. We call them fry. But even human females have eggs and they're, you know, come together as, you know, babies. But they have to be released as fry. So from the time the eggs get in a female to pretty much till they're up to a noticeable / catchable size is about 2 years. So they closed this a few months ago. What difference did it make? Absolutely none.
None.
All these fish were there. Everything was already here. You don't get 12, 18, 20-inch fish and more in the span of a few months. Physically impossible. But now, where were we before that?
Swivels
we were talking about.
Right. Well, with the visibility, and that's when we went into the line and the leader and all right. That.
So, to me, I have a different color line on every rod in my boat.
Right. And I'm starting to get that way.
And it people don't understand. It's not that I believe pink is better than green or green is better than blue or blue is better than brown. What I have found is by using different color lines, I usually have one rod that does better than the others. And unfortunately, I don't know how to tell which one would be the one they're either going to not notice, or maybe it upsets them, wants them to bite the line. But, and people say, well, I got the leader on, and the leader, that's the difference. Well, if you're casting against the mangroves or under a dock, I'll go along with the line color probably wouldn't make any difference, because the fish, you're casting and the fish are forward of where you cast. But if you make a cast and the fish are 20 feet closer to you or 10 feet closer to you than where your bait landed, what's the first thing that comes down on their head? The line, right? Lines up in the air, lands on the water, sinks down in the water, or at least lays on the surface. So the line's the first thing a lot of fish see. And first thing they notice.
And I think that the line would act as a trigger. The guy that fished that spot before you, he comes in a boat, makes all kinds of noise, he's dropping beer cans over the side, he's doing all kinds of crazy stuff, and he's lashing the water with this particular line.
And let's say he had green.
And so the fish see this green line, and they associate it with... And the fish that are there at that moment, I mean, we know they move all the time.
Right, but let's just
so
say
the fish that are there
in
at that
spot, those fish are there, and then he leaves, and 15 minutes later, you show up.
With green line?
That could be... I never thought of it
like
that way,
one.
RJ, but that's actually...
Yeah, so you show up with green line, and the fish say, oh, that guy's back again, we're going to hang tight.
Yeah, it's just...
But if you show up with pink line,
or yellow
or
blue,
line, so they're not cued into that particular trigger until you start doing the stuff the other guy did. And unfortunately, a good number of people fishing from boats, you know, they don't consider how much noise they make and how that affects the fish and stomping around on the deck and all the rest of that.
He doesn't but I'm going to steal that part for our talks from like now on.
Right.
Because that was like the best analogy
ever.
No,
that's absolutely phenomenal.
But speaking as a diver, you know, you hear everything underwater. And the slightest noise on a deck sounds like a drum roll in the water. And those noises are what spook fish.
Absolutely.
And so trigger them into something so that they see something and the noise comes and that upsets them. It's like they see it. Even without the noise now, they're going to go hide.
I like that. It's a really good concept. Now, you were talking about fish's vision, too, and another thing that they've learned in the last several years but are starting to not necessarily understand it more but kind of get a little better grasp on it is that fish see in some ultraviolet spectrums, too.
Yes.
And that's why...
That's a weird one.
That's a very bizarre one.
That's a very weird one. Do colors come across in ultraviolet?
There are shades of color through the entire spectrum. Now, whether you can call it red or green or blue, I'd say no, but they're seeing different wavelengths of light in the ultraviolet spectrum. Bees are that way, too. Bees see...
Yeah.
This really just hit me, just this moment. Is maybe that's why when you get fish down 60, 80 feet, it should not matter what color lure you have. Everything should be a black and white TV at that point, a black and white movie. So what's the difference if you're throwing a pink and white or a blue and white? It's shades of gray, you know, black, gray, and white is all you've got.
But if they're seeing an ultraviolet light,
bingo!
The higher the wavelength of anything, you know, radio wave, anything, it penetrates more. So ultraviolet light can be seen further down. That's why blue is the last spectrum just before you get to ultraviolet.
And
when you get down to about 200-300 feet, everything turns blue.
And in the 1960s, Berkeley, the original Berkeley Badeau, who owned Berkeley back then, did a bunch of studies, and the University of Wisconsin did a bunch of studies before they went wacky. They found that blue was the most visible color to many fish. number one most visible color they can see.
And that makes sense. As far as bass fishing, because they see blue to the greatest depths that they probably get down to, yeah.
So if they can see an ultraviolet, would pink and white be a different color than, say, red and white or blue and white?
Each color is a different frequency.
Well, and here's something that would play a role in that we didn't think about also. So add the ultraviolet part of it, add the two different lines or whatever, working one better than the other. If it's overcast, that's going to dull out some of the ultraviolet spectrum. Mm-hmm. If it's sunny out, that's going to make it more intense. Time of day with the angle of that sun, so maybe your green line in the morning wouldn't work as well as it might work at high noon because it has a total different perception. Or right. On an overcast day, when it's filtering out some of the different UVs, it's going to show off as a completely different color.
Yeah, and if you go to the real world stuff that we can see on the surface here, which is a black light, which is basically ultraviolet light,
right.
Colors change when you're in black light, which is, like I said, that's ultraviolet light. And if you've got anything that fluoresces in ultraviolet light, it'll really stand out. Like, wash your white shirt and tie it and go stand under a black light. You look like you're from another world, you know, with a bright, glowing whiteness around you.
Well, absolutely. And one of the studies that they did with the eye, with the vision, is that at different depths, different darknesses of water, clarities of water, pink was one of the most predominant colors that stood out the most, that stayed the most consistent. Chartreuse was a second one or third one in that color spectrum for some reason, both
really
under ultraviolet and regular light spectrum, that those two colors seem to be the more standout ones. Like that fish
that's
associated
why so many
with
people say, if it ain't chartreuse, it ain't no use.
Right, and that's why pink really works so unbelievably well, but guys are too manly to admit that.
Yeah, we've actually...
Yeah, nobody buys pink lures unless
right.
It's a woman.
Going
right?
back to...
It's
you
hard,
know,
to, hard
about
to sell
the
them.
Pink line.
Yeah.
Every guy at the store had the pink line on. And there was about three guys who were fishing tournaments who were actually smart enough to grab it. And somebody must have saw it because they were winning tournaments with it. And they grabbed the pink line. And now, like I say, it really doesn't matter. But it was such a cult thing then. Everybody's kind of hiding their pink line.
Well, and here's
you sold a lot of real covers, right?
Yeah.
Here's to add to that color thing. What's one of the number one selling colors that we sell when the water gets really dark?
Brown.
Electric chicken.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a popular color, but the guys that use it crush it and are amazingly well with it.
Yeah, the electric chicken now is the light green and pink, and the nuclear chicken is chartreuse and pink is electric chicken. Nuclear chicken is the darker, little darker green, almost a chartreuse, but a little more green to it, more of a
zombie green kind of.
Yeah. And then with the orange, reddish orange.
Right.
So you got the reddish orange and that little bit darker shade of green. Now, I would say the nuclear chicken is better in the dark water than the electric chicken, because I think the electric chicken's the lighter chartreuse with the pink.
Right. But maybe that's why that one tends to work. Maybe something with that light spectrum or ultraviolet, you know. And we've got a couple of those. Procure makes one that's got ultraviolets enhanced.
Oh, yeah, that's true. It's becoming more of a thing. Now, when we were talking about swivels and swivel spooking fish, one of the guys says, well, it can cavitate going through the water, and that might scare off the fish. And I said, well, you're absolutely right. That is a very real possibility. But we stock a lot of trolling lures at the store. We've got CNH. We've got Billy Baits. We've got
Williamson.
We've got, you know,
Islander.
No Alibi, Islander, all these different trolling baits. But when you look on them, look for the ones that say smoker or jet. Things like that.
Bubblers,
smokers. And what these are lures that you pull behind the boat going trolling, and they're kind of pocketed in the front. And, sorry, RJ, tossing RJ one of them. You're going to see some BBs in the front. This is a CNH lure rattle jet that we're actually looking at. And it's concaved in the front. It's got a pocket for a mouth. Now, in there, and then on on the sides, there's little tiny holes. And any lure says bubbler or smoker, what they're doing is having the water go in the face of the lure and then being pushed out through little holes in the side of the lure's head, creating little tiny bubble trails that come out almost like smoke. They're so fine, but it's a compressed water being jetted out the side of it. Cavitation. So sometimes cavitation can spook a fish away, but sometimes, now the reason I don't want to use a silver swivel with Spanish mackerel is by the time you tie the knot and then you put the swivel on, you've got the end of the knot, the tag end, creating cavitation. You got the water flowing through the holes of the swivel eyes as cavitation, and this silver thing glinting there, that's a bait escaping. That's actually a better lure than what I've got on the other end of my leader half the time. And it gets bit, and they bite it off. And a lot of it's, they're going after that cavitation.
Yeah, no, and we've seen that out there in the cleaner water with the Spanish mackerel where they come right up and take it right off right in front of you. Mm-hmm. And it boggles your mind that they can see it while they're moving as fast as they are and you're retrieving as fast as you are. Or even if you slow it down a little bit trying to help maybe reduce some of that cavitation, they still see it. And they still manage to catch it and bite it right off.
Years ago, I did a project with the Navy where they were pulling towfish. This was up in Seattle. They were pulling sonar towfish, side-scanned sonar towfish. And they wanted to see what it looked like. So they'd get us down about 80 feet, and then we'd sit in a target area, and then it'd come by with the boat, and you'd hear the boat go by. And then you'd hear this hum. And the towfish could be 300 yards back behind the towboat. And you'd hear this hum. And then all of a sudden you'd see the towfish, which looks like a long torpedo, a silver torpedo with little fins on the side of it. And you could see the cavitation on it because they're pulling it at speed. And there's little bits of streamy water coming out behind it that's basically filled with air, cavitation. And you would hear this hum. And the hum was always consistent. And so we asked once, we said, are we hearing the side-scan sonar? And they said, no, we don't have it on because we want to screw your eardrums up while you're down there. So all we were hearing underwater was the cavitation on the fins. So anything that cavitates, as far as I know, is making some kind of humming noise, some kind of buzzing, humming.
Could it have been the line they were towing it with humming in the water?
It could have been, but it was really loud when the towfish came by us. You could hear it coming, and then it would get just like a train, the Doppler effect.
Yeah.
It would get close, and it would get really loud as it came by, and then it would get quiet.
So I think you're right on that. But that's the only reason I was asking is because of the we know braided line, when you have it on a rod and it's stuck in the rod holder in your boat, the wind blows, and all you hear is zzzz. You hear this humming, whistling, buzzing noise.
And I'm sure that line does make some sound in the water when you pull it. It's just that, you know, we're looking at a towfish that's four or five feet long.
We don't hear it with monofilament.
You don't.
When you have monofilament line in same rods, braided on one, mono on the other, in the wind, the braided line is humming and buzzing and whistling, and the mono's quiet. So, I mean, we've actually put them in the rod holders and gone, what the heck is this?
But to go back to swivels, and I think Robert's right about that, the swivel's making some kind of noise in the water.
No, I'm sure you're right.
And whatever that noise is, it's obviously attractive to some types of fish, especially schooling pelagic fish like mackerel. So they're attracted to noise. They're attracted to cavitation.
Oh, yeah, sound chumming.
Sound chumming, exactly right. So
here's a question for you, RJ. What's it called when you put metal in the water and it get like it's supposed to create an electric field?
Electrolysis.
What is it?
Electrolysis.
That the word I'm looking for, like an electric field around it.
When it creates a magnetic field all the way around it.
Yeah.
Not electrolysis. Isn't that it breaking down?
Well, that's what happens when you put two dissimilar metals together. Electrolysis will cause them to eat each other. One becomes an anode, and the other one. eats the other one. So
okay,
that's why you put the lead on the bottom of your boat, so that'll eat the softer metal, the electrolysis. So.
What
electromagnetic field is what I've always heard it called.
Electromagnetic field. People say
is that still the same concept?
Yeah, same concept.
If I use a steel leader, the fish are going to sense that metal there.
You know, I'm going to go back to sizes of things. You know, if you got a 3x3 plate in the water, yeah, I guess they're gonna sense there's something going on here electrically, because sharks pick up on electrical signals and most fish do. But you're talking a diameter that is so thin. I mean, you can barely see it underwater. I can't imagine that it's going to be making something. I could be wrong about this, but I can't imagine it's going to do anything appreciable to your fishing.
Remember what I said about cavitation? It could scare the fish, but it could attract them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, billy baits, it's a part of CNH, which is actually all owned by American Fishing Wire, who, believe it or not, the president of the company was just trying to call me a minute ago. I guess he was listening. He didn't realize this is a live show. Yes, boys and girls, all these screw-ups are made live on air. Billy Bates has caught, it's a type of trolling lure, and their claim to fame when they were invented in the Keys, and AFW since bought them out, CNH, and they've kept the dissimilar metal factor in it. Their entire claim to fame for catching mahi and all that better than any other lures was the dissimilar metal creating that electromagnetic field in the water that actually got the fish to hit the lure.
Yeah, it's so, like dropping a 9-volt battery in the water.
I mean, that would be a great thing to put on one of these if you could.
Yeah.
But, so while people say, oh, I don't want that magnetic field because the fish are going to sense it and go away, Billy Bates was sold for a lot of money because they had dissimilar metals in them and the fish were actually checking it out, investigating, but they bite billy baits. It's a great lure for mahi mahi in the Keys, probably for fish all around the world. It's
probably one of the number one selling trolling baits in the Keys, I would guess.
But well, picture a pelagic fish's life. He's out in the middle of nowhere with a school of his buddies. And how does he know where to go to eat? You know, there's no neon sign saying eat at Joe's 2 miles down the road. So they're using every possible sense they have. They're lateral aligned for sound. There's got to be all kinds of things in their skin and their scales that detect electric currents and things like that. So now there's this school of bait fish, and they're creating an electric field because they're swimming and they're alive, and that's what sharks pick up on, you know, movement and electrical discharge. Now they know where to go for dinner. So if you're sending out these electric fields, I would think, especially if you're out in deep water, you know, where there's no main structure for fish to hang on, everybody's moving around, how do we connect? And I think that electric fields have a lot to do with it. Sound has a lot to do with it. Because, again, fish vision is not of great distance.
So
I like the ideas there.
I didn't mean to get on this tangent today.
Yeah, but you know what? This is kind of cool because it's actually challenging us a little bit to think a little bit differently than what we normally do. And it gets you to reevaluate a little bit, but it also opens your eyes literally to try to want to be a better angler, better teacher all the way around. You know, that's how stuff gets done and accomplished, and we've done it more than once in here.
Yeah, and it's myth-busting also, which I really enjoy. I mean, we grew up with a lot of myths, and we also grew up with a lot of good ways to do stuff that got changed because somebody came up with a harebrained idea that didn't work. But, swivels spook fish, and then you got mackerel biting swivels, and you see it all the time. So how does that play out? And that's just taking information and applying it to the real world. What did you see? What was your experience? Does it fit with what this guy told you?
Well, here's what I would say is the truth. Swivels scare fish. Swivels attract fish to the point they eat them better than some lures. You have to take each thing you're doing, each specific circumstance. Am I dropping a line straight down bottom fishing? Am I trolling it? am I casting? Am I freelining? And break it down for what works best for that particular fish or that particular style of fishing. And the things that are fixed rules are very, very, very few. There's almost no fixed rules because when you're fishing, there's almost no fixed, this is what I'm doing. You might be casting a shoreline that has a current that runs left to right. You might be casting a shoreline that's calm, or one with waves going against, or one with waves coming away from it. Muddy water, clear water, you know, there's so many variables when we go fishing that to say this is the rule is ridiculous. It's not feasable.
And I agree with that 100%. I went Arctic railing fishing, fly fishing. And I went with a guide and a couple of other guys, and they were catching fish, and I was getting zilch, nothing. And, I'm whipping this damn fly rod back and forth, and my arm's starting to fall off, and I want to catch a grayling. And finally the guide says to me, how are you tying that fly? I said, I don't tie them on. I use those little tiny micro clips. He reached over with his scissors, snipped it off. My fly went in the river and went away, and then he tied on one. My second cast, I had a grayling. So here's something that I'd fished almost my entire life using the little clips, never had a problem. Got to Alaska, the little clip didn't work anymore. So you got to know conditions, the fish species, you got to know what they eat, what they don't eat, do they like things moving fast or slow. This is all about becoming a better fisherman.
And just taking it to another level and enjoying the experience. It's the learning that's the fun.
It is. Without a doubt, the learning. And see, that's what sticks, at least in my memory. It may not be the particular fish I caught, but what did I learn in that process?
Yeah. Okay. I was just looking. And
We got to talking sometimes. We forget about the time. This is a radio station.
We have a limited amount of time, but I've been a little scattered this
week.
But
it's still fascinating.
Yeah, but we're...
I'd listen to the show again.
This is 35 years I've gone in. Robert's got like 22 years in it. RJ has been working underwater as a diver, a sports writer, all these things for all these years. And we actually sit here and go, that's the first time I ever thought of that. I was that revelation with the UV light that they actually see in UV that could mean they see colors down there at 60, 80 feet. Just because humans can't doesn't mean it's... I cannot, you take any mediocre dog around and walk through a room and he can follow you where you walk by the skin cells that you dropped on the floor. I can't do that. So that means it's impossible? No. I can't see with ultraviolet light, but a fish, if they can, that might be the reason why different colors work at depths. It should make no difference at all. I've always said I don't think fish see the way we see colors. They absolutely see color, but I just didn't think it was the way we did.
Yeah, and I didn't think it was the way we did either, but I mean, it's just our nature to humanize things. We put human characteristics into it because it's what we can relate to the easiest. So sometimes we forget about the basic stuff.
You mean like PETA? They started their whole organization on the fact that in the cartoon, Bambi's mother got shot?
Yeah. Okay. And that's...
That was really sad.
It was really sad. We got a whole
destroyed my childhood completely.
Animal movement.
I couldn't watch
a
Disney
cartoon.
Yeah, I couldn't watch a Disney film after that. I was so traumatized.
But that's what we do, though, to relate things sometimes of... does that fish see this way, that way, or the other way? Or does that fish feel the same things that we feel? Because it's the only thing we really have to relate to it. And so you have to kind of get outside
of
your...
Just remember, I'm in my safe space. Don't emotionally abuse me.
Right.
I'm in a safe space right now.
Yeah, you have to get outside of those little comfort zones.
Oh, well, that was hurtful.
I know. The wind blew the wrong way, too. So, but that's what it boils down to get some of these really cool thoughts and better processes.
Yeah, I'm sorry, guys. I'm probably not normal. Yeah, we know.
Both Robert and I put our hands over our mouth at that point, so we wouldn't say what we were thinking.
Yeah, normal's on the other side of the bleachers from Frank. But, you know, I enjoy learning. I enjoy listening. I enjoy helping people with fishing. I'm glad I got to spend the time I did with my dad. And I'm thankful each week about being here at this radio show with Robert in the chair across from me and my good friend RJ running the Command and Control Center. Thank you guys for joining us. We really appreciate it. It means more to us than you actually know. Thank you. Just to ease my mind.